hung with care. Tricia thought that Roy's appearance was the ruse he was using to divert attention from the transfer of April's stone to the bed and breakfast. The sounds of sirens going on around Magnolia and on up into Henry Hollow were real enough, she learned. She arrived to find half a dozen patrol cars from the sheriff and the highway patrol cordoning off a bend on Henry Hollow Road. From a nearby tree, a body swayed at the end of a rope. Dear God, she thought. A wave of nausea crashed over her. The sight was too much for several other witnesses, including Philip Farmer. He was recovering from losing his lunch in a nearby ditch. The woman was naked and bruised. She appeared to have been put in her place rather hurriedly. Her assailants needed to get in and out of the hollow quickly to avoid detection. "Who called this in?" Roy boomed out. One of the deputies came over to tell him that a call was made by Edgar Kennedy. Edgar was with another deputy making a statement. Roy and Tricia went over to talk with them.
"I don't know if I want to talk to you. We're not sheriff," the man said to Roy when he approached. "You already have blood of three other women on your hands. Now this. If another one comes up dead or missing because you decided not to talk with me, it's blood on your hands, Mr. Kennedy." Roy was visibly agitated. Tricia could tell that he was having a hard time restraining himself. "This ain't no fun for me, believe me," Roy clarified. "See what you can do about getting that woman down from there before the coroner gets here," he ordered. He turned back over to Edgar Kennedy. "If you don't want to talk with me, you need to talk with one of my deputies. I want this to be over even more than you do, believe me." Sheriff Roy stalked away and approached Philip Farmer.
"If you want my job, well, good luck to you. You obviously can't stomach a crime scene as simple as this one. Just think what'll happen the first time you come on an accident with someone's head rolled into a ditch 30 yards away. Been in the army my ass." He said his piece. He spent the rest of the time until the arrival of the coroner instructing his deputies to look for clues at the scene. Tricia confirmed the identity of the victim and did a quick inspection of the body. "She was tortured and garroted by the looks of things," she told Roy after her inspection. "The rope around her neck was placed after she was dead. I believe that she was brought here to hang as a warning."
"Think we're getting close then?" Roy asked.
"Maybe a little too close if you ask me."
"Should I put a man on your house?" he offered.
"No, just patrol as you normally would. Glenn and I might decide to go out to Jabo and Crystal's place out of Jumpstart for a few days. We'll program the house lights to make it look as if it's being lived in. Keep this just between the two of us, okay?"
The sheriff agreed. In another half an hour, Tricia headed back to Zeke's. She was met by Jessica Collins at the back door.
"The transfer went okay, right?" she asked Zeke Collins' widow.
"Without a hitch," Jessica replied.
"Your friend is worried about her daughter. Any news?"
"I'm afraid that the diversion wasn't staged. Willow Casey's body was seen hanging off a tree on Henry Hollow Road."
"Oh my," Jessica said. "Poor April. I wonder how she'll handle the news."
"Not very well, I imagine. I'm thinking of going up and talking to her in a few minutes. I'm also going to arrange for Harold to keep an eye on your place, at least for tonight. Russell's men might suspect that Willow stayed here and might just try to see if April stayed here, too."
Tricia decided to walk to the Blue and the Gray by way of swinging by Pastor Dan's house in hopes of throwing anyone interested in following her off her trail. She was welcomed into the Stevens house with open arms and invited to dinner. Before she could say no, she was seated at the family dinner table between Gracie and Emily.
"Have you had a good day?" Dan asked as a conversation starter.
"I've had better," she replied. "I'd rather not talk about it, especially in front of the kids."
Emily signaled to her husband that he should let it go. Dan changed the subject. After dinner, Tricia walked over to the Blue and the Gray. Lizzie Elston ushered her in and took her to the room where April was staying. She was found huddled up in a corner of her room in a fetal position, sobbing uncontrollably.
"She found out?" Tricia whispered to Lizzie.
"About half an hour ago. A man came right after dinner and told her. She's been here ever since."
Tricia dismissed Lizzie, then sat down next to her childhood friend, holding the woman in her grief. Not a word was spoken, nor was one necessary.
At some point in their vigil, fear crept into Trisha's consciousness. But for the first time in a long time, she realized her mortality. She held April even closer and stayed through the night. Obligation. Dawn crept through the windows of the blue and the gray. Trisha woke up with a realization that this was the first night since she got married that she had not spent with her husband. There's a short, polite knock at the door. You have company and breakfast waiting for you in the dining room. Lizzie's voice was reassuring. Trisha and April were safe. For now. The women composed themselves before heading to the dining room and the aroma of freshly brewed coffee. Jessica Collins is waiting for them at the breakfast table. Glenn sends his regards, she said. He'll be over here as soon as he's off. Trisha explained the situation. You don't need to explain, she was told. I had a visit last night just after you left with someone familiar with the situation. When I didn't hear from you, I deduced where you would be when you woke up this morning. Jessica let out a short laugh. They made it through breakfast. Lizzie went with April back up to her room for comfort and commiseration. Trisha and Jessica sat down in the parlor. I remember the incident involving the disappearance of the Browns. It happened soon after we moved up here from Portsmouth. Jessica got to the point quite quickly. It was one of the first things Zeke and I were involved in when we finally moved up here, she told Trisha. We reported on the search every day for the better part of 6 weeks. When the oldest boy, David, got killed in that accident just before Thanksgiving, we shifted gears. We collected gifts for the children so they could have Christmas. That went out the window when news came about the collapse of the Silver Bridge. The story dominated the news for the rest of the year and on into 1968. About a month after the bridge collapsed, Sheriff Ross announced that Jim and Nadine Brown were most likely two of the victims. At least that's what he said that the West Virginia State Police told him. Did anyone ever follow up on the announcement? Trisha asked. Zeke called the police in West Virginia at the time. They told him they had no way of knowing who might have perished other than the victims whose bodies had been recovered. So I take it that the sheriff closed the book on the Brown case. Pretty much, yes, Jessica Cole told Trisha. Zeke tried to get the Ohio Highway Patrol interested in conducting their own investigation, but no one cared, not even Governor Rhodes. By the following spring, the only people who cared for the Brown children were the various foster families they were living with, and not all of them were happy with what they were getting out of the deal. The Wills, for instance. Chet and Doris, I believe. They took in Frances. About the same time she turned 12 and a half, she started to run away from her foster home on a regular basis. Doris would come in here and raise a fuss about one or the other of the preachers Zeke had on the radio on Sunday mornings, claiming that they were taking the girl in and taking advantage of her when they could. Now, the sheriff would find her and take her back. She was never found at a preacher's house. It would always be at a friend's. She learned the art of avoiding the sheriff eventually, and rumors started that she figured out that she could sell her body in exchange for room and board. No one ever admitted to keeping her or to using her. She eventually faded away. Well, I was thinking about wondering what happened to Frances just the other day, Trisha told Jessica. The others are accounted for in one way or another. A twinkle appeared in Jessica's eye. She's still alive. At least she was the last time I heard of her, about maybe 5 years ago. She was living in New York under an assumed name. Trixie, I believe it was. Trixie Van Houten. She provided personal services to gentlemen. She's a prostitute? She actually manages others these days. She's a madam. Jessica tried to hide her obvious laughter. According to the NYPD, she earns in the millions for her call girls. Well, how in the world did you find that out, Jesse? Word gets around. Someone who used to be on the school board went to a convention and was recommended. He enjoyed himself for an evening and couldn't shut up about it. His wife heard of his dalliance through the grapevine and left him. He suddenly quit the board and left town to go live up in Michigan somewhere, but not before a few of us heard about him running into a girl from Fuller County who was operating the service. Trixie Van Houten? Trisha asked. Yes, Jessica confirmed. Trixie Van Houten, otherwise known as Frances Brown. Trisha just shook her head in disbelief. I have a number which you can try. I'll run it over to your office later this morning." Tricia accepted the offer, as well as a ride back down to Zeke's. After a short visit to get Trixie Van Houten's phone number from the address book Jessica kept in her kitchen, she went in through the back door of Zeke's to take her usual booth. When she sat down, she noted an envelope addressed to her peeking out from one of the menus in the menu stand. She thought about opening it before common sense prevailed. The envelope was placed in her portfolio. Whatever the message was, it could wait.
"I'm glad you made it back here." Glenn sat down with Tricia just after he finished the show.
"Any problems out at the house last night?"
"Not that I noticed. I'm planning on going over to the Village Hardware and ordering a security system," he told her. "Roy filled me in on the deal up Henry Hollow. Is your friend April okay?"
"Other than being crushed that both her daughter and her granddaughter have turned up dead in the past week, she's holding up pretty well." "By the way," she added, "did you happen to catch anyone who may have been in my booth this morning? I found an envelope addressed to me sticking out from one of the menus." She produced the envelope to show to Glenn.
"You may want to be careful with that," he warned her. Tricia dropped the envelope on the table.
Glenn asked one of the servers to bring a plastic bag and a pair of tongs. After placing the envelope in a bag, he started asking around to see who might have taken the seat in Tricia's usual booth that morning. There was general agreement that the booth had been empty until Tricia came in just before the end of Glenn's show. Sheriff Roy was called in as a precaution. In what seemed to everyone to be a day-long procedure, the envelope was eventually opened. There's no residue, just a note using letters from various magazines and pasted on a blank sheet of paper.
"She was a warning. Stay away or else. Signed, a friend."
For a second time, the employees at Zeke's Cafe were asked if anyone may have seen or may have been seen sitting in Tricia's booth that morning. Alex, a newly hired busboy working part-time, recalled seeing someone sitting at the table briefly just before closing the previous afternoon. Further questioning revealed that Alex's recollection of the man was vague at best. "I'm worried for you," Glenn told Tricia after the incident was over. "Bodies are turning up. I don't want yours to be one of them." "Not as ardently as I am," she assured him, "but sometimes getting to the truth means taking a risk. I just want you to be aware and keep those risks to a minimum." She smiled. "If I don't take the risk, what's to say that the body count won't go higher?" Tricia gave Glenn a hug. "I was at the risk of disappearing myself when I was just barely a teenager," she finally confessed. "I owe it to my guardian angel, and I owe it to the other women who just ended up like Betty and Willow. I must take the risk. It's my obligation."